Welcome to episode 304 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. On April 16th, about 2 weeks ago, U.S. climate envoy John Podesta gave an historic speech to the Columbia Global Energy Summit that has received almost no attention in Canada, even though it may rewrite the rules-based international system that has governed trade since World War II. The new White House Climate and Trade Task Force will introduce new rules and penalties for countries like China that sell goods and services to the United States with high embedded carbon emissions. Quote, here in the U.S., we want our manufacturers to be the cleanest and most competitive in the world, end quote, Podesta said. Make no mistake, the creation of the task force is the beginning of a new phase in the global energy transition. My guest, Canadian economist Dr. Chris Bataille, was in the room when John Podesta gave his speech. I'm eager to get his take on where the U.S. is going with this new approach and what it means for American allies like Canada. So welcome to the interview, Chris.
Great to be here, Markham.
Well, it's good to have you back. I mean, I've done a lot of interviews with you over the years, many of them on video, not enough of them in the podcast. So the podcast, of course, is our sort of long-form energy journalism where we have conversations as opposed to be doing newsy items. And I think that this is the topic that really does require a longer conversation because of its importance. Now, you were there. You listened to the speech. Give me your impression. What was announced, and give me your impressions about it.
Yeah, I know that's a really, really good question. We hadn't been expecting this. And then what was interesting is that Podesta was simply supposed to have a fireside chat with Jason Bordoff, the head of Center for Columbia Global Energy Policy. And instead, at the relatively last moment, he asked for the podium to give a speech. And it was a very carefully crafted speech. And you could tell he was reading line by line from it. He was not to deviate from it whatsoever. and it's online. It's available. Just Google search the White House Podesta April 16th Columbia. And if you read it carefully, there's a lot in there.
By the way, I did read it carefully, and that's why I gave the introduction to your interview that I did.
Yeah, I would argue that speech could be on par with Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech in the early 40s after World War II. In terms of the redefinition of how we look at global trade. So at the end of World War II, basically everything outside of North America was broken, busted, and blown up or worn out one way or the other. The U.S. was the banker for the world. It got to set the rules for global trade and the international order thereafter. And it's called the Bretton Woods system, the IMF, the OECD, and a whole bunch of institutions were born at that point in time. And all our global trade rules were set at that point in time. And they were set up to solve that era's problems. And a lot of those were in reflection of what happened in the 1930s, where a lot of protectionism kicked in at the wrong moment and basically crashed the global economy down about 30% in the early 1930s. So the whole point of all this was not to lock up free trade, is to keep free trade going no matter what, and get all the benefits globally, get all the benefits of it globally. Now, the problem is it was acknowledged at the time that it was supposed to have at least two legs. There was free trade and a financial element, but it was also supposed to have a workers' rights or labor element to it. And that was never settled, right? A third element kicked in the 60s and 70s that they understood was missing from Bretton Woods was the environmental part. And there are some clauses, 20 and 21 in the WTO, that allow you to say, I'm going to put tariffs on this, or I'm going to prefer domestic supply for these security reasons or what have you. But they're very vague. And the language in there is from the early 1940s and 50s. The problem is what's happened is when China was brought into the WTO in 2003, I believe, or 2001 or 2003, no one understood how fast how fast they would become so productive and dominate so many of the global energy chain, basically production chains. The problem is, they ended up, all sorts of manufacturing and industry globally started collapsing, what have you, in Europe, in the US, what have you, all sorts of regions started falling apart because of this. But it's also on the back of an extremely GHG intense production chain. So their electricity is very GHG intense. Their workers' rights, obviously, there's all sorts of issues there within the Uyghurs and what have you. We've effectively become somewhat dependent on a supply chain that goes straight back into very GHG intense Chinese electricity and questionable workers' rights. Sorry, go ahead.
I wanted to make a point here, and you mentioned the word vulnerability. And I often bring up a speech that was given in November of 2022 by Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo. And she said that in the first year of the pandemic, so that would be 2020, that the Americans woke up, this is her words, woke up to the threat posed by their vulnerability to Chinese supply chains. That really set off a nuclear bomb in the policymakers' thinking in the U.S. about how to approach China, how to approach the global energy transition. And out of that flowed the U.S. Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act. And so I just wanted to flag that sense of vulnerability that has, a lot to do with what we saw, what we're seeing from Podesta's announcement.
I would argue, Markham, that the old trade order died in November 2016, when Trump won, when basically the Rust Belt states that consistently voted blue switched to red. And it was a very strong signal that the global trade system was not working for the US anymore, and for US workers and for the US middle class. And I think that is the fundamental thing they're setting out to repair, is protecting their own into a certain degree. But the Europeans are very much in the same boat with them. Now, so what you're seeing now, all of Trump's tariffs on steel, on all sorts of the random things that he did over 4 years to friends and foe alike, that was like a backlash to exactly what we've been talking about. What the Biden administration is trying to do is think through this far more carefully. They're throwing out the old rule book. Right, the old WTO rule book. They'd obviously like to keep the better bits of it, but their first priority is their own, and that's quite understandable. And what we're going to see is, if we see a second Biden administration, is you're going to see a whole new set of trade rules emerge, and they're going to prioritize security of supply for critical supplies in the U.S. They're going to prioritize their workforce. They're going to prioritize the environment, which I think is extremely important, the GHG intensity of goods coming in. And they are spending a tremendous amount of money on the supply side with CHIPS, the Infrastructure Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act, in order to build up innovation and supply side. And they're putting on demand. But now they're going to have to start thinking about putting up barriers in order to protect those investments, which is what the Europeans have to do with border carbon adjustments.
Yeah, exactly. And the border carbon adjustment is kind of a form of carbon pricing. And carbon pricing is verboten in the US. You cannot talk about a carbon tax that won't fly. I mean, I know California has cap and trade and so on, but generally at the federal level, it just is recognized that it won't fly. But you have to punish, you have to do something about these embedded carbon emissions. And this is as I was reading Podesta's speech, it was like, oh, this is carbon pricing in another, without calling it carbon pricing.
Well, imagine the way the administration thinks of it. I'm pretty sure Podesta thinks of it this way: is they think of U.S. manufacturing as being relatively clean, which is true. Specifically electricity, what have you. Arguably, Canadian manufacturing is even cleaner, right? But we don't benefit from that at this point in time. They want it. What the several bills that are moving around the U.S. Congress and Senate right now are treating U.S. intensity as a factor of one, and anybody who's above one is going to get penalized. An GHG intensity of one for a given product is going to get penalized coming into the country. Now, it's de facto a form of carbon pricing, but the question is, what's the stringency? Because that's going to You know, what's that dollar per ton shadow price that's sitting on there? They can't do domestic prior carbon pricing, right? But they are doing all these subsidies. And I wouldn't be surprised if they tag, if they level up the level of subsidy with the charge that's coming in some way.
Well, let's talk about the three parts of the task force that Podesta described in his speech. And the first one is develop a climate and trade policy toolkit. And he said at that time in the speech, he said that the U.S. has an open mind about what approaches are most effective at addressing carbon leakage, carbon dumping, and embodied carbon in general. So it sounds like they probably have some ideas of these, but they're not ready to go public with them yet. They were going to flesh them out a little bit more.
I think that's code. That's code for they're willing to do bipartisan work with Republicans willing to advance bills in terms of structure. So there are several bills moving, both Democratic and Republican and bipartisan bills moving around. It's code that they're willing to talk with all of these folks to build the support necessary to get through something through Congress.
Oh, interesting. Podesta also mentioned the negotiations that are led by U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai for EU and U.S. global arrangement on steel and aluminum. And I know you do a lot of, you pay a lot of attention, because I see you on Twitter all the time talking about it, about decarbonizing steel production in particular. So I imagine that you have been following these negotiations. What can you tell us about those, and how might they be relevant in this context?
Yeah, no, this is super interesting. So back, the EU operates a very standard economist, from the economist textbook, emissions trading system called the EU ETS, right? And they've been gradually expanding the sectors covered by it, taking away the free permits, and raising the price by tightening the number of permits. The problem is the price is starting to get pretty high. It got up over 100 euros per ton there for a little while, 9,100. It's backed off to 60 because it's been so effective at driving emissions out of the electricity sector, and it's just the way a cap and trade works. But the problem is, once you start getting to that strength of price, and it's applied to all emissions, you have start having to protect those industries that are subjected to them in the bubble, right? So what the idea is, they've started measurement already of GHG intensity of commodities moving in and out of the European Union. In October, I believe it's January 1st, 2026, they're going to start actually pricing steel and a few other commodities moving up. Now, this has really upset a lot of developing countries, specifically India. But the problem is they can't have the ETS at the stringency it's at without the border carbon adjustment. Now, their assumption was that their trading partners would all just put on carbon pricing and just negate it and keep the money themselves. Not they wouldn't collect the money that those foreign. But the problem is it's the EU system was like this. It ran into the US system like this because the US can't do domestic carbon pricing, right? So you've got the US negotiators talking, or you negotiators talking this way, the US negotiators talking at basically 90 degrees to each other. They have to find a way to find some sort of equivalence. And this is where these bills in the US Congress start to matter, right? Like if the Europeans can accept all the subsidies the US is putting on their domestic industry, plus some sort of border carbon intensity or carbon pricing mechanism as being equivalent to the CBAM and the internal EU ETS, we're going to be all right. But the problem is it's when you get, you know, and if the Americans can accept the European version, we'll get to some sort of agreement. But they've been 2 years trying to get to an agreement and got nowhere, and they had to halt it before the elections. Where we're going to have problems is if the really old U.S. steel mills, the ones running blast furnaces and not electric arc and DRI, try to export into the European Union, because that's when the Europeans will by law be obliged to charge a very hefty border carbon price and start basically a trade war with the U.S. But they've got to find some sort of equivalence agreement.
Okay, then we're going to keep an eye on that, because that's obviously really important. I want to talk about the second thing that Podesta announced: credible, robust, and granular data to implement smart climate and trade policies. And now I have some personal context here. You know economist Kevin Byrne of S&P Global. Mm-hmm. And I've been interviewing Kevin probably for about 10 years, because he started work doing emissions in the Alberta oil sands. And over time, as emissions intensity has become a greater and greater competitive issue and a trade issue, Kevin has now been drafted to head up the global team at S&P Global around emissions intensity measurement.
Correct.
And the thinking there, he told me, is that as that becomes more of a competitive issue, then companies are going to want to know with great specificity what their emissions intensity is and that of their competitors. So this becomes now a business issue to have access to this data. And that was the first thing I thought of when I read Podesta's comments about data.
Yep. So the Europeans are about 5 years ahead, 5 to 10 years ahead of everybody else on this. They've been talking about a CBAM for almost a decade now, and they really got serious about it about 5 years ago. They started the process of working up the measurement systems for that. It's insanely complex. But they're effectively, by doing it, they're almost setting a template for how it could be done. The question is where it runs into collision with how the Americans want to do it, but they haven't decided on a system yet. Like that is a fundamental problem. The Americans have barely even begun the process of setting up a data intensity measurement standard, whereas the Europeans are quite a ways down the road, and nobody else has even begun. They're not even off the deck. I really hope Canada's talking about border carbon adjustments. I really hope someone in Statistics Canada, Environment Canada, and NRCan is doing work on this, because it takes a while to figure it out.
Now, about 3 months ago, I contacted Environment and Climate Change Canada about this very question, and they sent me a spreadsheet of emissions data broken down by province, by economic sector, by economic subsector. I mean, there's a lot of data in there.
Yep.
And that is, it doesn't go down to the facility level, but it's pretty granular. And my impression was, when I'm going through that data, that somebody's been paying attention to this. And I know from my conversations with Kevin that there have been a lot of discussions about methodology. How do you measure something? What assumptions go into the math that determine the number that you eventually come up with for emissions intensity? So given that we're not just starting, we've clearly been doing something along this line for a period of time. In your opinion, where is Canada relative to the EU and the US in this approach to data?
I think, to be honest, I think we're going to be okay. We're not that far behind. Our data collection has been a little haphazard over the years. It suffered a real hit during the Harper years. It was world class before that. They've done a lot of work to repair it since. The Europeans are going to be applying CBAM and doing their measurement at the facility level, right? So that's a standard we've got to hit. So this comes back to my earlier point about the Americans. 80% of their steel is extremely clean, right? Can go straight into the EU, no border carbon charge whatsoever. Roughly 20% of it is very problematic. It's very old blast furnaces, right? So the EU is more than willing to look at the facility level where that steel came from and charge on that basis. So what you might just see is steel swapping between destinations. I think we're going to be all right. Where this is going to run into problems is where the EU has one method, like boundary definition, what's measured, what are the benchmarks for data that's not known, what method the Americans use, what method we use, and what the rest of the G7 and the Indians use. Like, we need a common system. Like, we need an ISO for this, right? And we're not there yet.
I want to ask you the implications for the Alberta oil sands, because that is the bulk of the oil that gets exported from Canada. Canada is the world's fourth largest oil producer. We are not small potatoes when it comes to this. We do about 5 million barrels a day. And the oil sands, and again, this gets back to Kevin Burns' S&P Global data, 68 kilograms of CO2e per barrel, which is very high. Very high. I think the Norwegians are down around 9
mm-hmm.
kilograms, something like that. So that gives for comparison. But in the averages are hidden small, uneconomic, inefficient projects I shouldn't say uneconomic, but inefficient, up to as high as 160 kilograms of CO2e, 120 kilograms of CO2e. I cannot believe, like I could see the Americans, if you're looking at 44 kilograms of CO2e, which is the most efficient modern oil sands plants, you know, that compared to 31 kilograms, which is the US national average, you say, okay, you know, we'll figure that out. But at 160 kilograms, that's got to be a problem if we try to export that over the border.
Yeah, and you're touching on something that's become very salient. Okay, so as the satellites circling around the Earth and measure methane and CO2, they get better and better and their resolution gets higher and higher. What we're realizing is a lot of the emissions are coming from super emitter events, right? So you've got maybe 80% of the pack is, we're doing okay, right? But you've got a few places where something happens and a whole lot of methane gets blown off or a whole lot of CO2 is being used. Now, those satellites are just going to get better and better. They're going to be used, they can be used on a legal basis for they're down to the pixel, like the, you know, meter squared level where you can assign it to a facility. I think we have to tighten, like, Canada's got pretty deep, like there's two components to that emissions intensity per barrel, right? There's the CO2 component, which is the combustion CO2 and the process CO2. And then there's the fugitive methane component. And our fugitive methane rules vary a lot across the country, and it did depend on the process. But BC is global class in terms of fugitives, right? Even Alberta's kind of 1.1%, 1.7%, depending on where you're sitting. It's okay. It needs to come down 75%, down to point below 0.5. Doable. Saskatchewan's got issues. It's 10% across because it's all heavy oil, right? A lot of associated gas coming up. It's being flared. Flaring is never really complete, generally, unless you're running cyclones. It's these intensity per barrel measurements can get very granular. Anyway, you've got a point to make.
Well, I do, and that is the associated gas in Saskatchewan. So that's one issue. The problem is that in the oil sands, it produces very little methane. It's right. Not fugitive methane emissions that are the problem in the oil sands. That is a problem in the conventional and in the gas.
But you use a lot of methane to make steam to extract sand, extract the bitumen.
Yes.
So it is a problem.
Yes, when you're burning it, that's exactly right. I mean, that's the bulk of the oil sands emissions, right? Is burning that natural gas to make the steam. And within the context of this discussion, last week, Cenovus Energies, which is one of the big oil sands producers, one of the big four. And it's, I think he's now chairman of the board. He was CEO, and that's Alex Pourbaix. And he wrote an open letter bemoaning the fact that Canada hasn't come to the table with tens of billions of dollars to pay for carbon capture to make, you know, to lower the emissions from the oil sands. Given what Podesta announced on April 16th, and given the trends that you're talking about now, you can see why oil sands CEOs are absolutely frantic to get that money in. The pressure is on now, as far as I can see, to lower emissions because of what's coming. And this is fairly new. And now that's my take on it. Do you think I'm accurate or not?
No, I think you're on the ball. I do think, though, an industry has to pay for all its own costs itself and still be competitive, right? Like, we can't subsidize it with taxpayer dollars. The first CCS plant, yes, to prove the concept, right, of a couple of different types. But no, that money shouldn't be coming out of the Canadian taxpayers' pocket. It should be coming. They should be able to sell their product at sufficient profit with adequate emissions controls on all emissions controls, or not operate. Like if I don't have insurance, if I do things that cost other people money in my own business, I will be charged for it. I will go to jail or what have you. Why is this different for them?
I'll tell you why it's different. And this came out in the net zero modeling that the Canadian Energy Regulator did last year. And I interviewed the chief economist, whose name escapes me just at the moment. But what he said, and I went back and checked the modeling because this is quite fascinating. He said, if the oil sands producers are required to pay their own climate policy compliance costs, it will make them uncompetitive. And as prices fall into the 2030s, we will see a large contraction of supply in the oil sands, meaning companies are going to go bankrupt. They're going to reduce their supply. And I'm not talking about, you know, from 3.5 to 3.2 million barrels a day. I'm talking about 3.5 million to like 1.6 million barrels a day. It's a major, major contraction if they have to pay for their own GHG reducing activities. They will not be able to compete once we hit peak oil demand and prices begin to fall. That's what's on the table here. And I think that's why the Pathways Alliance, which is the Oil Sands Trade Association, that's why the CEOs like Pourbaix are stepping up the public pressure. And they don't talk about that, right? They don't, none of that gets put into the public conversation. And I really think it needs to.
Well, the simple fact is, if we're going to stay within the 1.5 to 2C window, there's a consistency across studies that crude oil production and consumption is going to fall 70 to 80%. We're going to need that last 20 for chemical feedstocks, and someone's going to provide it. And the IEA, this is the numbers you're getting here. They go from Canada drops from like 4 or 5 million barrels per day down to 1.52. Right, that's the part that we end up being competitive for. Now, that's bad for the industrial structure and wages and what have you for the existing. But we've got 30 years, we've got 25 years to reorientate that industry into making net zero synthetic chemicals, net zero aviation fuel, chemical precursors, all sorts of things. Right,
carbon fiber. All
those skills are completely applicable to the commodities of the clean commodities of the future, but they have to get on it now.
But that's the problem, Chris. And I've made this argument in columns, is that Alberta, where all of this activity takes place, Alberta is the land of incumbents. And incumbents, as many experts have told me over the years, always gatekeep change. And they always, when you're an incumbent, you have three options. You can build a completely new business model, you can re-engineer your existing business model, or you can double down on the existing business model you've got. And I think after Suncor abandoned any kind of energy transition strategies last year, it's pretty clear that Alberta Oil and Gas has doubled down on the status quo. They are trying to resist change. They're not trying to cooperate with and facilitate change. And that becomes a major, major problem for Canadian energy and climate policy. It already is. I mean, it's why we're seeing the big fights between Premier Danielle Smith and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau over these kinds of issues. And this leads me to the third point that Podesta made. And it's more of a vague signal, but it's the one that actually caught my attention the most. The task force will identify what more we can do at home and abroad to further position producers to thrive in this new race to the top environment. That means that it's an admission that the U.S. is in a global clean energy arms race with the EU and with China. And the American government is taking it very, very seriously. And there is no way that producers as big as the Alberta oil sands, or maybe it's electricity system, whatever it is, they're not going to be able to slip by unnoticed.
No, and that's absolutely true. We need a national, okay, this is the thing, is Canada is a federation, right? And we've handed a lot of powers and a lot of decision making to our provinces, both structurally and by matters of you know, sort of just common practice, which means that we now count on the provinces on building net zero industrial structure plans for themselves, industrial policy, or just plans for the future one way or the other. And arguably, I'm not really worried about British Columbia. I'm not worried about Quebec at all. I'm getting less and less worried about Ontario. I think they're starting to wake up and smell the coffee in terms of electric vehicle manufacturing, nuclear, you know, the things that they're good at. I am very worried about Alberta. I'm worried, like, just the moratorium they put on, effective moratorium they put on wind and solar is now cut off. They were the fastest growing wind and solar operators in the country. They cut that off, right? They, you know, you've got the investment emissions from Dow Chemical and what have you. There's a few other bright points, but, you know, Alberta could make hay out of this. Alberta, Saskatchewan could very much make hay out of the net zero, the clean industry, global clean energy transition, and they're choosing to go another path. And the ultimate price will not be paid by the companies. They will move on. The CEOs will collect their bonuses and paychecks and move on somewhere else. But the workforce is there, and the provinces and the capacity to pay for public goods will suffer if those jurisdictions are not competitive going by, you know, 20 years from now.
Chris, this has been our argument for the last 4 or 5 years at Energy Media. We have argued this over and over and over again. We're thumping this tub as hard as we can. I agree with you 100%, especially about the argument that Alberta could actually make hay with this. You know, we've talked about how the Alberta could transition the oil sands and its bitumen from making feedstock for refineries into making feedstock for carbon fiber and asphalt binder and activated carbon and other things, and how they can use captured CO2 to make products like vodka and cloth and what have you. So this is the problem is it seems to me that what Podesta announced 2 weeks ago was essentially, it kicked up the American response to the energy transition by a factor of one or two. Like, it was very, very important. And as a supplier, we're one of the hinterlands that supplies the metropolis with its raw materials and other inputs. It behooves us to pay, as Canadians, to pay attention to this. This is a huge signal from Washington that the game has changed. And I did a Google search to see if there were any news stories that had run about Podesta's speech. Not a one.
Yeah. What's interesting is if you compare, like, if you were to compare Alberta to Texas, what's going on in Texas? They're absorbing an incredible amount of sun and wind very, very quickly. They have the most open permitting regime in the U.S., and it's stunning to watch it happen. Adding batteries and what have you. Yeah, there's hiccups along the way, but they're transitioning their electricity system extremely quickly. And all along that south coast there in Louisiana and Texas, they are putting in the beginnings of clean of net zero industrial hubs. You've got CCS clusters, hydrogen clusters, clean chemical clusters. They're working really hard to get CCS permitting to work. Yeah, sure, a lot of this is not popular with people, but this is part of the transition, the deep industrial transition. And Texas is going to be just fine.
Yeah. Well, the stuff that you're describing, though, those hubs, for example, coming out of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes, they are. And also the one before, the IIJA, the Big Infrastructure Act. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got people like, and I bring up Jigar Shah all the time because he's so well known. He's a former clean energy investor, now runs the Department of Energy's loan program, has got tens of billions of dollars. And he runs around the country as an evangelist for these kinds of projects. And he's been pushing hydrogen hubs, for example. He's been pushing virtual power plants. And that has accelerated the acceptance in the U.S. of that kind of an approach. And I know he's been active in Texas in setting up some of these hubs that you've been talking about. Whereas in Canada, oh, and by the way, the other thing is that even though Texas talks a good game about preventing the U.S. federal overreach in the state and so on, when it comes to these kinds of activities, it's basically hands off. It hasn't taken any specific measures that I've noticed, to stop the federal government from doing what it's doing. Unlike that, when they sued the Obama administration over the Clean Power Plan, there they had an active pushback. Here, they're just sort of tolerating it because it's, hundreds of billions of dollars flowing into the state. Whereas in Alberta, the Alberta government has passed the Sovereignty Act. It's basically saying, that every federal dollar that gets spent in Alberta has to be approved by the Alberta government. And it is putting up barrier after barrier after barrier. Some of them are legal. Some of them are, they're questionable constitutionally, but they're doing it. And politically, they're putting up a fence around the province, exactly the opposite of what Texas is doing. And that is a big problem because Alberta is 38% of Canadian emissions, even though it's only 12% of the population. And it really is, at the end of the day, the heavy industry center of Canada. If it doesn't transition, we're in big trouble.
No, and the problem is they've been playing a game for about 5 odd years now. We're just delay until the Conservatives get in, right? And then the Conservatives, they figure they'll gut the. Parts of the Conservative Party may want to gut climate policy, but I think very smart bits of it realize that the game has shifted. The Americans have shifted. The Europeans have shifted. The Chinese, like literally, the Chinese have completely revolutionized the global auto industry at this point in time, and soon the freight truck industry, right? So it's reality has moved on without us, and just assuming climate policy is going to go away is a loser's game at this point.
That's exactly right, and it's very short-term thinking. And in order, and if you're looking at it from the CEO's point of view, if when Alex Pourbaix was sitting in the CEO's chair at Cenovus, if you look at their investor presentations, they are promising investors that they will return 75% to 87% of their company's free cash flow. Now, I had venerable energy economist Phil Verlager on a couple of times, and he said, when the investors start demanding that level of return in the form of share back buybacks, and it's basically they're asking for their capital back.
Yeah, it's a shutting down of the industry.
Yes, exactly right. And so what they're doing is the CEOs are playing this very, they're walking this knife edge where they have to keep their investors happy. They don't want their stock price to tank. They don't want to be fired because they, you know, their stock price fell by 50 bucks or whatever it is. And at the same time, they have to look like they're playing the game, the long-term game, where they're putting, you know, responding to climate policy, and they're going to be competitive. They're going to be the last barrel standing. It's a commonly heard in Alberta. And but behind the scenes, it basically, as Verlager said, it's a sunset industry and they're shutting it down.
With all sorts of implications.
Oh, massive, because oil and gas is Canada's biggest export sector by a factor of at least two. It's huge.
Yeah, no, and it's too bad. Like, not that long ago, it was auto parts.
and auto parts now would come in number two at about $60 billion, and oil and gas is out around $120 billion. Most of it to the U.S., of course. But this is the Podesta speech is another milestone that tells us, it signifies to the extent to which the global system, energy system, and the other systems that support it is changing, and how rapidly it's changing and how thoroughly it's changing. And Canada, parts of Canada get it. I think in BC and Quebec that we absolutely, you know, those provinces absolutely do, but other parts don't. And that is not a good recipe for a successful adaptation to change.
What I found interesting about Podesta's speech is they'd been working for a couple of years trying to get a deal with the Europeans, right? And there was some frustration because literally they're not talking the same language with each other. I'm not worried about that in the long haul. They'll find all the grounds for agreement. But what he laid down is that no matter what anybody else does, the US is going to plunge forward with their own version of trade and climate policy. And, you know, if we're not aligned with that, we're going to get burned.
Yeah, and thus far we are not aligned with it, and we've tried. I'll give the Trudeau government credit for this. They have, over the course of the last, especially since 2019, they are trying to align those policies. They're trying to put in, you know, the carbon system that works. Clean electricity standards and clean fuel standards and so on, but being met with so much pushback from the provinces that it makes implementation very, very difficult, and has made us laggards in this space instead of leaders, and that doesn't bode well.
There's another thing in Podesta's speech you might want to mark. He said, we're not pulling the ladder up after us. We're going to climb, but we're not pulling the ladder up after us. So what I read into that is that we're going to help along, and we're going to work with anybody who's working in the same direction as us. And we're especially going to help pull up. We're going to pull up our less fortunate allies. I'm not talking Canada. I'm thinking like our allies in the developing world that are aligned with us. We will haul them up with us. But the implication is anybody who comes crossways of them is going to run a cuppance.
Well, look, one thing Podesta also mentioned at COP28 that Vice President Kamala Harris launched the Clean Energy Supply Chain Collaborative. And he specifically said like-minded countries, and they're going to create high quality, secure and diverse clean energy supply chains for all of those clean energy technologies, you know, like batteries and electrolyzers and EVs and on and on. And that would seem to be an indicator, you know, that if you want to play ball, play in this game, that you need to get into these initiatives and work with the Americans. And I want to talk just briefly to wrap up our interview about the recent announcement just a few days ago that Honda is going to spend $15 billion to build an EV plant, an EV hub in Canada. This is big news. And just as predictable as the rising of the sun in the east is all of your conventional economist colleagues, who shall go unnamed to protect the guilty, immediately came out and criticized it as corporate welfare, and we could spend that money somewhere better. And I will give you my standard response to that. You can either build it like China did, or you can buy it. If you don't build it, you have to buy it. And if you don't do either of those things, you're not going to get to play in the clean energy economy of the future. And Canada, to its credit, it is at least trying to buy its way in. You know, I think the provincial and federal governments are putting up about $5 billion of that $15 billion to get Honda. But that's the price to play in this poker game. And if you're not prepared to pay for it, if we're going to whine and snivel about every, you know, dollar that we put out like this to make sure that we build these supply chains and the industry, that is not a good sign.
I would put these billions that everyone keeps getting excited about, like 5, 10, 15 billion, like our economy is well into the trillions at this point. Like on an annual basis, government expenditure is, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions every year, one way or the other. The Europeans are spending this kind of money. The Americans are spending this kind of money. The Chinese in their own equivalent have been spending this money for 20 odd years. And they built it. This is the price. Like, imagine your economy is like a super tanker going in one direction. There's a cost to spinning the rudder. Right. And pushing off in another direction that, like, say you're heading towards the rocks with your super tanker. There is a cost to shifting off to the clean channel, to the channel without rocks in it. I look at these as rudder moves more than anything else. And they're signaling. Now, I might argue some more billions for electricity infrastructure to beef it up across the country from
like high voltage provinces.
Yeah, and also the high nameplate stuff like high voltage inner ties, but also just help for the utility, like right down to the voltage shifters in our neighborhoods and what have you. So the French word came in and not the English word. I don't know why, but it's like, it's from top bottom to top. We're working with a 1950s electricity transmission architecture. We need hundreds of billions of investment over a couple of decades to bring it into the modern era where electrons can flow wherever they want, wherever they're coming from, right? In terms of supply, demand, what have you. That we need that too, on top of these nameplate things. So anyway,
a month ago, the context for my next comment is the moratorium that Premier Danielle Smith announced in August of last year, then formally ended on February 29th, but introduced enough rules that it's now become kind of a soft moratorium. It will greatly impede the expansion of wind and solar in Alberta, even while she says that they're going to promote it. But here's that's context for the interview I did a month ago with Otto Rahman, who is the grid planner for the Alberta Electric System Operator. And I asked Otto about these kinds of things, because my context for this is the Americans and the Europeans and the Chinese who are building out these electricity systems, just as you described, They're transforming their power grids in real time. They're modernizing them. And I sort of laid that out for Otto. And I said, like, what's going on in Alberta? Alberta seems to be behind. And he says, he denied that, of course, because that's his responsibility. Yeah. I get it. But he did say, he said, look, we're gonna integrate a lot more wind and solar into our power grid. And we're already investigating and implementing many of the power controls, digital controls, power electronics, high voltage, changes to transmission. All of that is either underway or we're studying it and we'll be doing it in the near future. He gave a very, very different view of the Alberta power grid than you would ever get from the premier.
Yes.
and it's fascinating to me that the agency, the technical people who keep the lights on in Alberta, see the power grid so differently from the politicians and the policymakers. And that seems to be a conflict there. And maybe the politicians, their rhetoric is nothing more than that. And you know, the real work that needs to be done will get done anyway, because that's technically required. But what I fear is that the hesitancy, the conservatism of people like Danielle Smith will impede the work of people like Otto Ramon. That's what I worry about.
I have no worries about the technical competency of Alberta to transition. Right.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
The engineers, the workers, the labor, the what have you. And it was happening anyway. And to my experience, it's culturally probably the most entrepreneurial province that we have going. Right. The resisting such a business model as the clean energy transition, it's a bit of a weird, almost it's like reflexive social media phenomenon. Like it's, I don't understand it. I get the idea it's attached to incumbents and they're supporting it and what have you, but there is no resisting this. It will happen anyway, but it can happen slowly, faster and cheaply, or slowly and more expensively. Right. And, investors, people with all their hundreds of millions of billions of their own money coming to regions to invest in factories and invest in all sorts of things, they see these kinds of things. They're going to put their money where it's safest from any sort of political risk.
Well, Chris, that's probably a good note on which to end, because the argument that you just made is literally the argument we're making now and have made for a number of years. And we could have a very spirited discussion about why it's like that and how that operates in the Alberta context. We've done a lot of work here at Energy Media about understanding that, but that's grist for another podcast interview. Chris, this has been fascinating. I learned a lot today about what's going on at the international level and how all of this, how Podesta's speech fits into the broader context, which I did not understand as I read it. I understood some of it, but you've really helped me put it into the broader context. So thank you very much for this.
My pleasure as always, Markham. And thank you very much for the conversation.